good morning once again, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn where the things we kind of look at in daytime and say, oh, come on, we take another look at after sunset, and they look totally different. And we're going to be looking at a couple of interesting things tonight after sunset. I have several things I want to do at the top of the show. This, of course, is Open Hailing Frequencies. We are going to be opening the lines. And so let me start at the very top and give you those numbers so you can be thinking about dialing, even if you're not dialing. The obvious number is 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802. And our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. Just call that, dial that in, and you will get to us. Before we begin tonight, before we open the lines, and you can dial any time if you want, I want to hit a couple of things at the top. One is, this is November 11th. This is Veterans Day. Used to be known as Armistice Day. And there are some very interesting numerical coincidences, patterns, symbologies about this day. First of all, of course, we want to remember all those who have given our country such very important service. Without, you know, the service of the men and women who have devoted their lives, given the last full measure of devotion, we would not be here. We would definitely not be here. All I can say is, you know, we definitely need to, someone needs to turn their mic down, thank you. We need to pay attention to what this day is supposed to memorialize and represent, and that is the honor of every man and woman who has served in the armed forces of these United States and who have kept us safe. One of those people is the person I want to talk about next, because if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, which will take you to our show page for tonight, there's a very interesting news story at the top. It's our only link tonight at the top of the page under Radio with Pictures. Jimmy Carter has had an analysis of his condition. You know, he announced several months ago that he, in fact, had cancer. And in fact, it was probably the most deadly form of cancer you can imagine. It's an inoperable brain cancer. And so he held a press conference there in Georgia several months ago and then resolved that he was going to go back to doing what he normally has been doing following his so-called retired routine, which involves globe-trotting around the world and checking on various hotspots and monitoring elections and building houses and, in general, you know, as he's approaching 100, trying to bring humanity to as many human beings as possible while he has time. Well, the news hits everybody, you know, in a very dramatic fashion. Not the least of all me. And so I went on the show one night and I said, look, here's an opportunity. We can catch the wave. We can become the pilot wave for millions of people who are wishing the president, you know, well, wishing him that he gets better, that this cancer goes into remission, and that the problems that he would obviously be beset with in terms of the accelerating prognosis would in fact go another way. Now we're several months down the road, and the news as of this evening is that there is no new cancer detected in Jimmy. The president appears to be holding his own. The doctors, of course, are attributing it to his regimen of mainstream procedures and protocols and activities and whatever, you know, treatments are being done, which, of course, are private between him and his doctor. The interesting thing is that there seems to be moderate to significant surprise on the part of a lot of people that Jimmy Carter is no worse, no better, holding his own, continuing his schedule, teaching Sunday school classes, and proceeding with a normal life, if one can imagine living the active life he lives at approaching 100 as normal. And, you know, someone sent me this news story, and he labeled it possible torsion field news, because if, as Sherlock Holmes said, you have eliminated, you know, all the things that are impossible, whatever remains, however extraordinary, must be the truth. Is it possible that this audience is in fact doing something with Jimmy Carter that is not in the purview of mainstream science? Is it a continuation of some things I was wanting to talk to Oberon Zell about last night, and we just didn't have the time, we couldn't get to it, which is, which is more effective, leaving a ritual or a spell or a whatever you want to call it hanging, so that every time you mention the word Jimmy Carter and cancer and he should be healed, you're pinging the force, you're pinging the field, you're reinvigorating that template, which is Jimmy Carter is going to be fine. The other modality, which I wish I'd talked to Oberon about last night, is those people who think that these incantations, these spells, these rituals, whatever you want to call them, that invoke the consciousness aspect of the physics to achieve certain objectives, that has to be closed, it has to be terminated, it has to be kind of, you know, tied up with a nice ribbon, and it has to be brought to an end. Those are those two diametrically opposed approaches to this. I must say that my instinct is that you don't close it, you leave it open-ended. So every time you mention Jimmy Carter, there's this ping that goes through the force, this ripple, that basically reinvigorates and reimagines the ideal, which is he is fine. He's not going to die of cancer. And so the news today in that context is very, very interesting indeed. We seem to have our first caller. I think we have our first caller, or did I not quite get there in time? Oh, I didn't get there in time. So please try calling back, 505-796-8802, or Skype handle Enterprise Mission. I'm going to get to some other things shortly, but let's see who this is. Good morning. Turn your device down. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from. Hello?
Yeah, hello.
You are there.
Hello. Oh, my gosh.
You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Big question for you, and that is zero-point energy. Are you for or against zero-point energy?
I didn't know we were taking a vote.
Okay.
What do you mean, am I for it or against it?
Are you a proponent? Would you like to see zero-point energy developed and implemented?
Well, yeah. I mean, zero-point energy is not a matter of vote. It actually exists. If you look at the so-called Casimir effect, where you take two polished metal plates, really highly polished, optically polished, so they're basically accurate to wavelengths of light, and you bring them very close together within a few thousand wavelengths of light, they will try to move closer. The pressure of the virtual particles coming into and out of existence around them, and the fact that there are fewer particles in between them, mandates a force that pushes them together. So there is actual experimental evidence, again called the Casimir effect, that the zero-point emergence and disappearance of virtual particles in space-time, in the torsion field, in fact, exists. So it's not a matter of being for it or against it. It's how can it be harnessed? How can we create technologies around this? And there's a very long and venerable history, you know, regardless of what it's called, of gadgets and technologies and machines that have been invented to do exactly that. And unfortunately, there's a political problem at the U.S. Patent Office, because the patent examiners have been given specific instructions to deny patents to any claims to perpetual motion, to free energy, to hooking into an unlimited reservoir of energy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the deck is kind of stacked politically against getting a patent on these machines. There are political ways around that, which some night we probably should discuss on the show, but I'm not quite sure what you mean when you say, am I against it or for it? Because obviously, well, I'm for it, because it's real. It works.
Yeah, but here's my point, Richard, and that is, Can you imagine what the U.S. or Chinese or Russian military industrial complex could do with unlimited power? You know, the poor Krell, the poor Krell.
Yes. But you can look at any nation state on this planet at this time and say the same thing. Are any of us really wise enough to make use of that kind of energy, that kind of extraordinary power? I mean, to me, that's one of the reasons why we don't have it.
It's really frightening. Quantum computers. I just worry about the future of this planet of ours.
Okay, well, on that note, anything else to worry about before we go on?
No, go ahead and take your other callers. Thank you, Richard.
Okay. And our number is 505-796-8802, and our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. Let me, while we're waiting for someone else to join the spotlight, why don't I tell you about something else? I think we'd finished up everything having to do with Jimmy, the fact that there's been no spread of the cancer, in his analytical tests, no appearance anywhere else. He's holding his own. He's functioning normally. I mean, this is extraordinarily positive news. This is amazing news, and perchance we might actually begin to think that we might be involved somehow. Okay, please turn your device down. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Is it me?
It's you. There's nobody else.
Hi, Richard. How you doing?
Doing fine.
I picked up your book recently, the Emoluments of Mars.
That is not my book. That is a spoof run by a couple of really zany pranksters, one from Europe and one from the United States, who are pretending that's my book. That's not my book.
Oh, well, I wonder if I read the right thing then. My question is, did you write the book in jail?
No.
Well, maybe I read the wrong thing.
I would go back and read again.
Something about a planetarium credit card. I don't know.
Next they'll have me stealing ships. Speaking of which...
A cruise ship?
Maybe. Was that it? Hello? Hello? We seem to have lost our caller. Okay, the other thing I want to tell you about is we've been working for about a month on a very important show, which is going to take place here literally 24 hours from now, tomorrow morning, on this stage, on this set of airwaves, on these digital devices all over the world. We're going to be presenting a story of the most extraordinary icon, and the fact that the United States is in danger of losing this icon simply because nobody knows it exists. I mean, imagine if I came to you some night and I said, here's an opportunity. We can save a priceless piece of American history. They're going to cut up for scrap the Statue of Liberty. And you'd look at me like I was totally nuts. How could anybody, any student of history, any citizen, any American citizen with pride of country and pride in terms of what the lady standing by the harbor represents, how could they just stand back and watch her, cut up into scrap for a few, pennies per pound? Well, something as tragic and as horrifying in terms of the equivalency is going to happen in the next few weeks unless those of us that care, those of us that actually want to see this not happen, get together and pay very close attention to efforts to save the most extraordinary passenger ocean liner ever built in the history of humankind. And I'm talking about the SS United States. And I'll resume that momentarily as soon as I find who this is. Good morning. Who are you and where are you calling from?
You keep lying when you ought to be stupid. And you keep losing when you ought to not bet.
I think this is another call from Belgab. Okay. Okay, let's go to James. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, I was wondering, is there anybody picking up Dr. Tom Van Flandern's work? And it seems like you'd be the right one to do it. Seeing all the videos, or all the pictures coming down from the satellite orbiting Mars,
mm-hmm.
it seems like you would be the only choice. Is anybody picking up his work? I mean, because I'm sure you've seen his videos and.
Of course. Are you in a noisy environment? You have a very loud background.
Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Are you in a truck?
I'm sitting outside by the road.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Can you maybe roll a window up or something? It's really annoying.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
And I was sitting outside. And but who's picking up Dr. Tom Van Flandern's work? I mean, because he has the best satellite. It seems like the best pictures, but I guess. Or maybe he just had first pick and he got all the really good ones.
Well, when you say first pictures, you mean, are you talking about his model that there was a planet orbiting between Mars and Jupiter and it blew up 65 million years ago?
Not his model. The actual photos that he had coming down from the satellite. And you've seen his lectures, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And you can see like the radiosymmetry of trees and roadways and tracks and...
Well, he had access to the same imagery that the rest of us have access to. Tom's interpretation of some things was a little more, it was separate and independent from some of the other analysis that I've been presenting on this show. There were areas where we overlapped, there were areas where we agreed, there were areas where we basically disagreed. The main area of agreement that I had with Tom was his old model, the so-called exploded planet hypothesis, that this solar system in the not-too-distant past, roughly 65 million years ago, and if that date sounds familiar, it's because that's the date when the dinosaurs disappeared, and Tom's ideas convolve into what may have happened to them. Tom's model, based on his expertise as a celestial mechanics individual with background, was to do the past orbits of many of the solar system objects and to reconstruct those orbits to where he was able to calculate the possible position of a previous unexploded planet in the solar system before about 65 to 100 million years ago. And then for whatever reason...
Was that with the Fibonacci sequence?
It was what?
Was that with the Fibonacci sequence?
No. This was basically work on a celestial orbit diagram that came from the Russians' fractional orbital bombardment system, where they would put a spacecraft into orbit that wasn't in orbit, it was in a partial orbit, and they would time it so that it was snuck up on another spacecraft, they blow up their spacecraft, and they take out the target. And the modeling of the orbits of that procedure reminded Van Flandern of the orbits of certain long-period comets that come back into the inner solar system only every few million years. And when he started putting these models together in the computer, it basically became obvious to him that some major catastrophic event, like a bombardment explosion in Earth orbit that takes out other satellites, had happened on the scale of the solar system. And that's when he began putting, pieces together in his model of a former planetary member, Planet 5, which for reasons unknown blew up between Mars and Jupiter, and now there's a ring of debris called the asteroids where the remains, the very small percentage of material that did not get exploded to escape velocity or dive into the sun after this event took place, that remnant is still orbiting the sun as the collection of asteroids and long-period comets. So that's the part of Tom's model that I really embrace, because our independent work with Mars and with the tidal Mars model and all that has definitely confirmed that there were major elements to Tom's EPH model that, in fact, are true. Okay, James?
Yeah, that whole wall where the comets come from, I always thought that they never came from the Oort cloud. They would come from that exploded planet. That's why a lot of comets have... the building blocks of of life and proteins in them and stuff is because it got blown up from an ocean on a water world that, you know, was live.
And that's one excellent possibility. The other possibility is that some of the comets we see coming back are not in comets at all. They're not huge natural bergy bits. They're not fragments of an exploded planet. They are, in fact, huge habitats, space habitats, which were destroyed in the explosion and have now come back leaking atmospheres and venting oxygen and other materials like water vapor, because they're basically huge ships and they're melting and the atmosphere inside is leaking into space. Some of the data from some of the missions, particularly NASA and ESA, really seem to tell us that that's what we're looking at in close-up on some of these objects.
Very interesting, just to think back. Yeah, because I personally think that we were, you know, a spacefaring society way back when, millions of years ago. We've already, you know, been blasted Stone Age several times and, you know, come back. And whether it be us or our predecessors, another, you know, but it's very interesting, to say the least. And thank you very much for putting me on this path in life of just researching all this cool stuff like that, you know, other civilizations throughout our solar system. And also, I remember seeing one time that you had shown some stuff of lattice work in the rings of Saturn. I've only saw it one time, and then I haven't been able to find that stuff on you anymore. Do you remember? I'm sure you remember making a video about the structure in the rings of Saturn.
Well, I actually gave a presentation in England, and we have to move on to our next call, but let me do this quickly. A few years ago at Leeds, and I did discuss some things that had been found from the Cassini mission in and around the rings of Saturn, and what I plan to do is to do a U.S. version of that, update it, and then put out a decent video, because the video that was shot was not very good quality. And I really think that if you're going to talk about this outrageous stuff, you need to have imagery which, you know, is commensurate with the outrageous stuff. So I was never happy with the image quality of that presentation.
Please put it out. The world would love to see that. And thank you for your contribution to to all this knowledge, man. Thank you.
Hey, we're just trying here.
All right.
Later.
Have a good one.
Okay, bye. Okay, Stephen, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio.
All righty.
Would you please comment on Earth?
Please turn down your radio.
Got it shut off. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was just wondering. I've been a longtime fan of yours. Been listening to you since I was 8 or 9 on Art Bell's radio program back like in the late 80s, early 90s. Is there any way we can actually find some of your old shows or even your new ones here on the Dark Matter network that kind of like, you know, on the TuneIn app, I can go back and listen to old Art Bell shows. Is there any way we can find yours?
Yes, it's called Club 19.5. If you go to the main page, othersideofmidnight.com, in the upper left-hand corner, there's a little logo. It says Club 19.5. You click on that. That takes you to a very simple subscription process, and for $5 a month, you get to listen to all the shows we've done here, however many times you want to listen to them. You know, it's basically the price of a cup of coffee at Starbucks for a month of listening.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I just found it. Great. I'll definitely log into that then and join it, because I've always been a great fan, you know, of some of your topics on there. Honestly, I've gone back and looked a lot at the Mars pictures and everything, and, you know, I can't see anything but a bunch of rocks. But, you know, it's very, very interesting, and, you know, I appreciate the work you've been doing. You know, I know you've been under a lot of scrutiny from a lot of different people, but you've always stuck by your principles, and, you know, I got to applaud you for that. You know, I'm definitely in your corner.
Well, thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, and you have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Okay. Who is calling, and where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hello. Turn down your device, please. When you call the show, you have to have your device turned down so that you don't have feedback.
Oh, awesome. Yeah,
time to...
Can you speak up? I can't hear you.
I'm afraid we can't hear you either. I'm so sorry. Okay, let's see who else. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Joe from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. About 7, 8, 9 years ago, I was on a website, kind of like a chat room, and it may have even been on the Enterprise mission. I'm really not sure. But as I was on there, you popped up there, and we kind of had a little talk, and I asked you if there was any research going on in reference to any video analysis on 9/11 of any free energy beams that may have been able to be picked up in either the video or photography. And the time you said that was being looked at,
mm-hmm.
and I just thought I'd call in and ask you.
Oh, did we lose you? Oh, darn. Tell you what, call back. I have your number here, 9605. Call back, and we will try to hold a place for you. Because you were getting to an interesting question, and unfortunately, I don't read minds very well, so I can't really answer the question. Many years ago, right after 9/11 took place, Mike Barra and I wrote a series that appeared on the EnterpriseMission.com website. And that's available if you go to the very bottom, othersideofmidnight.com, and you click on Enterprise Mission. That will take you to the Enterprise Mission site. You can, you know, enter a search in, look for keywords like, you know, 9/11 or World Trade Towers, and that will take you to, I believe it was a 3 or 4 part series that we did, analyzing all the factors at the time that the horrible events of that day took place. That, of course, is a long time ago, and I have forgotten some of the details because I haven't refreshed my memory in looking at the details, but I do know that there were a number of videos that had been submitted at that time that were in the if category, if they were real, if they hadn't been CGI'd. There was a lot of controversy over a lot of video that was recorded on that day and subsequently aired. So I'm not totally familiar with the status of the video at the moment because I haven't had time to keep track of that with all the other things that are going on. Tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. I want to play, you know, Bobby Bright's song that he wrote for us in Australia, The Other Side of Midnight. That's where you are. We'll be back in a moment. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. The Other Side of Midnight. If you really listen, you can hear what the universe is saying. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My producer, Scott McKay, in the break, he reminded me that there is a very important book, a very informative book, which was published some years ago by Dr. Judy Wood, called Where Do the Towers Go?, which has incorporated all of the stills, a lot of the video, a lot of forensic analysis. She's a materials expert. She's brought a very significant expertise to the entire problem of what really happened on 9/11. I gave a presentation in Amsterdam some years ago featuring her work because her work, her forensics of the materials, the actual analysis of the steel beams and the dust, the all-pervasive dust that came from the, in her words, dustification of those buildings, including the mysterious building number 7. All that analysis is in her book, Dr. Judy Wood, Where Do the Towers Go? And for anyone who is seriously interested in the real forensics of what happened during 9/11 and what the implications are for a stunning, non-state-of-the-art, secret black ops technology that was used to bring those buildings down, I would strongly recommend Dr. Wood's book. On that note, Laura, you have joined the conversation. What would you like to talk about?
Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is morning for me. I know that this is probably night to you, but for me here in Chicago, I actually get up around this time because I find it's the best time to work. Everything's quiet. There's no email coming in, no text messages, no phone calls, no traffic noise. It's my favorite time of the day.
Oh my gosh, you have a time machine.
I love it. It's the greatest thing. I am still a member of Club 19.5. I want to give that a plug. It's the greatest thing going. I download the show every morning, put it on my iPod, and if I, you know, can't listen to it in the morning, then I'll listen to it throughout the day. So I want to thank you for making that available. I want to talk – go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the show is not on at the most convenient time for a lot of people, although us night owls, you know, kind of feel at home.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of people who are professionals who do what you do, and they listen on their time and their time frame, and they can go back and listen to – some of the conversations get perhaps a bit technical. So if you go back and you listen a couple times, right, you can pick up context. I try to interrupt probably too much to define terms. But, yeah, Club 19.5 is the neatest thing since sliced bread, as my grandmother used to say, because it lets you become your own network. You become your own network programmer. You get to listen to this show when it's convenient for you to listen.
Right. And if my clicking on my computer wouldn't make so much noise, I would open up my iTunes and tell you how many shows since July 20th I've downloaded.
Ahead. Oh, go ahead. Come on.
Go ahead. Okay.
We don't mind the clicking. No.
And this is also great for long plane rides, which I'm going to be taking one in a couple weeks. I'm flying over to Europe, so I'll just be able to put on my Other Side of Midnight playlist. And let's see how long this is. I have 86 shows going back to July 14th
when you
did the Pluto special,
yep,
right? Remember that was
Richard, we need to get Laurie to do a commercial.
She's doing a great commercial.
Well, this is so important to me because you know how this all started? And this is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. I don't understand the hostility coming from the guys at Belgab. Belgab started off under another name, which I'm sure you know. It was a place to go for information about the other show, which, Richard, you were a huge part of because, now let me look at that playlist. I have 24 shows with you and Art starting 1994 going to 2007.
Wow.
And I was a member of that other program, so that's why I was able to download a lot of those. But for the caller that called, I don't know, about a half hour ago,
mm-hmm,
and asked about old shows, if you go to Belgab and you search through some of those threads, you can find people who are making their archive available for free of those old shows. And those old shows are great, Richard. The synchronicity for me was before Art came back on the air and before I knew you were getting this show, I was listening to your – I don't think it was your first show with Art. I think it was your second show. The whole thing with NASA and the moon and Apollo got me so hooked. I was listening to all of that and you were talking about the moon landing on July 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had heard Art's non-compete was going to be over with Sirius, and he was coming back on the air on July 20th.
Mm.
And I was wondering, and come on, and I had even asked on Belgab if anybody knew if that was done on purpose.
Well, that's the first thing I asked Art when he called me up and wanted me to be on the show.
Yeah.
I said, come on. The 20th? Give me a break. Did you? He said, yes, I planned that. Of course.
Oh, good. So. Well, that's great. Yeah. So that if anybody's looking for old shows, just head on over to Belgab and ignore the noise and look through and you'll be able to find them. So
Laura, yeah, you know, there's so much about these shows, both Art's and mine, that are kind of synchronistic. I mean, when he called me up and he said he was going to do this new thing, Midnight in the Desert, and he wanted to position a show for me following him, obviously, so the audience listening to Art could listen to what I'm going to do. The first problem, the first hurdle I had was, well, God's sake, how do I follow Art Bell? I mean, you know, it's
sure,
like,
right,
it's David Copperfield. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was. So then I'm thinking, okay, if I'm going to follow Art, what do I call the show?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to thinking, well, we don't think alike on a lot of things. I mean, Art and I have very different opinions.
Right.
What we agree on is process. We agree on asking good questions. We agree on asking follow-up questions. We agree on letting people who are positions of authority not get away with simply calling on their position of authority, but defending evidence with evidence or counter-evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But we have specific ideas on specific things that are in some cases really radically different. So then I started thinking, okay, the other side of midnight. I mean, it just, you know, it's like apple and, you know, jam and jelly and peanut butter and jelly and horse and carriage and love and marriage and all those things that go together. So, yeah, the other side of midnight came out of specifically Art's invitation for me to do a show following him on this network. Now, what's going on in terms of soap opera land, I have no idea. I have such little interest in soap opera.
Yeah.
And remember, back when Art and I were doing shows a long time ago, I actually said on the air, I coined the phrase, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
Mm.
So when someone is writing something, you have no idea if it's the real person writing whatever is being claimed that is real. It is almost impossible to check out on the internet that things are real or things are not taken out of context, or people who are having casual conversations want to get in the main conversation because it makes them feel big. I mean, there's a lot of people over at Belgab who have too much time on their hands and they need active, productive things to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writing soap opera is not a useful, productive thing. So that's what we don't do here.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, hey, great name.
Richard and Laura, I have a productive thing, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Keith and I both want to know what kind of headset Laura is using.
Me? Come, Scott, please. Okay. So I don't want to, I don't know what the rules are. I don't want to talk about myself or plug anything I'm doing, but I have recently started my own podcast and was desperate to find the best headset. I'm actually not using a headset right now. I'm using probably the sixth microphone that I've gone through in the past 3 months, right? Trying to find the right one.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where I got the idea for a headset. First of all, let me just back up. Dave Disler, when he was on your show the first time,
right.
I wrote to him and he wrote back. I said, you have to tell me what kind of microphone you're using. This is when I was in the beginning of trying to find the best one for my podcast. He said he was using the microphone on his Samsung mobile device.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
What? What? So, so where was I going? I am using an Audio-Technica 2005 USB mic. No, sorry. It's a USB and an XLR. I was using it as a USB, sounded terrible. Somebody finally convinced me to get a little preamp that will plug into the USB port on the back of my Mac, and then the other end plugs into the mic, and I just have regular headphones on. But it's made a world of difference, I think, in sound.
Well, it sounds as good or better as Bob Zanotti's mic from Swiss Radio International the other night, and he's got a professional setup where he was calling from.
Yeah, wow. We're kind of surveying everybody who has good headsets and mics because we're trying to find one for Scott.
Well, here's the thing, is Art was using Periscope. Do you know what Periscope is? That live video thing
it's connected to Twitter?
Live,
yeah, right.
Yeah, actually, he used that before the show even started. He and Aaron were driving into Vegas to go see a movie, and they kind of propped it up on their dashboard so that we could see what they were seeing on the drive. It was great. So he was just getting everybody all excited for the new show to start. So Art did a Periscope of himself doing the show. I don't know, this was a couple months ago. And I noticed that Art wears a headset.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried desperately. I wrote to his producer. I actually started writing on Belgab. Nobody knew what kind of headset it was because, you know, he sounds fantastic, as do you. And
we,
I thought
we actually have the same headset.
Oh, Richard, what is it?
I'd have to take it off and look. Hold on.
Okay.
We'll pause for dramatic effect as we
Is somebody Skype?
It's an Audio Technica.
You? Get out of here.
No, it is an Audio Technica. I don't know what the model number is. I'd have to go across the studio to get the box where
That helps because there are only so many.
Mm-hmm.
So why I wanted a headset is because I wanted to be able to move around and not have to face the mic the whole time. You know, because the mic is attached to your head, right? It's attached to the headphones.
Yeah, there's pluses and minuses. As you may have noticed, that there the sound noises that the headset was making in the beginning, I figured out there was an adjustment on the actual headset that loosens or tightens the wire connections. And
what?
when you loosen it, it doesn't transmit the mic cable sounds to the rest of the headset. Just little stupid things like that that are not mentioned in any of the literature in the box. The box was like they were packaging the SS United States, and there's this little headset in there with no manuals, no nothing to, you know, for best performance, do so-and-so.
Right, right.
So it's a learning curve. But so, yeah. So you have essentially the same headset.
Well, I have a mic that's, you know, it looks like a stage microphone. It's like, it looks like the Stevie Nicks microphone. And I have the foam. Do you have a foam, I think it's called a pop filter on your mic?
It's actually called a windscreen, but yes.
Windscreen.
Yes.
Yes. It's not a pop filter. Okay. But I think that it made a huge difference when I switched from a USB cable to an XLR cable. But in order to connect that to my Mac, I had to buy, it's called an interface. And this one is made by...
you realize we're in danger of people falling asleep because we're talking technology.
I'm sorry. I could talk, you know, smack about somebody. So.
No soapbox. I've got them stacked up. I really do have them stacked up. One final thought.
More NASA, more Apollo stuff. I wanted to ask you about the Flickr photo album that they've posted with all those detailed photos of the moon, what you thought. I'd love to hear a show about that.
Okay.
Just more Apollo, more moon, more NASA.
Okay.
Love the show. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Laura.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. I think we lost our other caller. Yeah. Okay. So we've got about 15 minutes to the top of the hour. Our numbers here are 505-796-8802, and our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello? Well, I don't think we're going to be accepting that call. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
You know why the soap opera's happening. It's because you didn't pay Ross.
So we're now going to discuss staffing in front of our international audience. Are we sure people want things to come out that they actually signed an agreement not wanting them to come out? And I guess we've gone away. Okay. The thing that I'm not going to do with this show is to turn it into soap opera, and there are certain things that should remain private and certain things that do not remain private, things that are public policy. Obviously, we discuss things that are private to the running of the show or how people are retained or if they're not retained. Those are things that remain private until the parties agree for them not to remain private, and I, of course, have not agreed since I, at Ross's urging, signed a document where we both agreed that everything that transpired between us would remain just between us. So we're not going to talk about that anymore. Again, our number's here, 505-796-8802. Skype handle, Enterprise Mission. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, Richard.
Speaking.
Yeah, I have a bit of a delay. Excuse me for 1 second.
Are you calling from Australia?
No. Florida, actually.
Oh.
I just wanted to say, not everybody out there is a bell gabber, so keep up the good show.
We're trying. Look, we have a very diverse and really significant audience all around the world. I know that because every morning and every night I'm answering tons of email. 99% of it is very positive. I've been trying some experiments. Some people are discombobulated by experiments. Others are not.
Honestly, I don't even know the whole story. I've just been listening tonight. And, yeah, keep up the good work. Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Quick shout-out, SorceryNet.
SorceryNet?
Midnight Express.
Midnight Express. Okay. We got you.
Everybody go check it out. Yeah, forget Bell Gab, all that bullshit.
I don't think you can say that on the air.
I'm sorry. Keep up the good work. Thanks,
okay.
Richard.
All right. Night.
Yeah, the standing rule is if you're a bull, you can do it, but you can't say it.
So. No, you cannot say it while you're doing it. Okay, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Washington State.
And what would you like to do with us tonight in the way of topics, conversation, guests, soap opera, whatever?
I'm just curious if Richard C. Hoagland has any friends in the oceanography line of field of work, and just trying to discover if there is any alien technology at the bottom of the ocean, per se, instead of using telescopes for that far out in the space. Why can't we use some sort of telescopes or to see at the bottom of the ocean to see if there's actually some hidden technology down there?
Well, that's an interesting idea. I mean, it's, you know, again, in the maxim that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Even if folks came here that were just a bit more advanced than we are, they could conceal themselves, they could live under the ocean. You'd only see them when they exited or entered, and there are reports of strange craft entering the oceans at high speed or exiting. But in terms of actually checking out, the assets to do that are in the hands of the U.S. military and other military on this planet. And remember, every once in a while, the Swedes chase something in the Baltic Sea, and then it goes away, and we're told it's Russians. Is it Russians, or is it something else? In other words, you could spend your life chasing your tail on things that you can't check out. I can physically check out what's on the NASA and other space imagery. And with I and my colleagues, we have done analyses now that are proving pretty incontestably that we are surrounded by a solar system filled with artifacts. Whether someone is coming and going and hiding under the oceans on this planet is frankly a lot more difficult to determine, because we don't have access to those clandestine and hidden data channels. Okay? I guess they got their answer.
Hey, Richard.
Yeah.
We got a nice email just now from Georgia Lambert, one of our former guests.
Georgia, yeah.
She says, "Hi, guys. I was listening and heard you mention the ocean liner, the United States."
Please turn down your device. If you don't turn your device down, I'm going to remove you from the air.
Okay, all the dogs in the neighborhood are awake. Anyway, Georgia says she wanted to let us know that she got to travel first class on the SS United States from Germany back to the U.S. in 65. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Would she like to join us tomorrow night?
I don't know. I recommended that she tune
in. Why don't you ask her to join us? Because, I'll tell you, Ian, if you can just hold on a second, I want to complete something that I was going to tell everybody earlier.
You bet.
Tomorrow night, we're going to have a remarkable show featuring a producer. If you could mute your mic, Ian, it might help. All right, there's a little noise in the background there. We're going to have a producer-director who is going to be regaling us with the story of the SS United States. This is this fabled ship that was built in the 1950s by this government with the cooperation of the U.S. Navy in a very clandestine Cold War posture. It became the most extraordinary ship ever built, passenger liner. It still holds the record for the fastest speed of crossing of the Atlantic to this day. And tomorrow night we're going to be telling the entire story, including what you can do to I think we're going to have to eliminate that call because they did not turn down their device. So, you're on the air. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. What was the full name of the woman, Laura, who was just on?
Yes.
What was her full name?
It only comes up in the first names on my screen.
Okay. Now, you seemed like you knew her. You were talking about headsets.
Well, she had called a couple, 3 weeks before, and I had noted to Scott that her headset sounded really good, so Scott jumped in and asked her about the headset. That's all.
Yeah, no, I was actually taking notes when you stopped her talking. I have a Mac, and I was looking for a good quality headset.
Aren't we all?
I was hoping you'd walk across the studio and get the box and tell us what you had.
Well, I'll tell you what, during the break, I'll do that, and when I come back, I'll report to everybody what model number my Ars Technica headphone mic combo is actually coded under.
And if you could talk about your mic with your windscreen set up, that would be nice.
Okay. It's just boring technology. I mean, remember when ham operators used to only talk about their ham radios when they established contact with somebody halfway around the world?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That kind of, you know.
I actually want to be on a podcast with someone, and I don't have any good equipment, so I was actually looking at investing something decent.
Okay. I have an idea for the caller. If she follows us on Facebook on Other Side of Midnight, once I get all the details about these headsets, I'm going to post about it.
Hmm. That's a good idea.
That'd be a great idea. Yeah, that would be perfect. That way everybody could go at their convenience. And
without taking up valuable airtime, because most people are not into mics and headsets, yes.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoy your show.
Well, thank you.
Good evening. Well, bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye. Okay, Ian, you are now on.
Hey, Richard. I want to know what you think of I'm from Brisbane, Australia, by the way. I want to know what you think of the recent talks about the discoveries on the pyramids and the Great Pyramid with the thermal imaging and so forth.
Yeah, we've been following that. In fact, I have a call out to Dr. Carmen Bolter, who is one of our friends. She's an Egyptologist.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
She's somewhere in the Caribbean doing a documentary, a many-part television documentary on the Mayan artifacts. And I haven't been able to reach her on Skype. I reached her, you know, a few days ago, and I've left a message. Because if anybody would know what the politics are behind the scenes, she was actually quietly arranging for us to be in conversation with some of the key antiquities people. And then, you know, she went out of range, and we've kind of lost track. So hopefully in the next few days we'll reestablish communication, and I may be able to get her on the show to tell everybody what's going on. Because, as you said, they have an independent team there contracted to use some very sophisticated new technology involving not only muon detectors, but apparently very sensitive thermal imaging.
And they what I heard was this was pretty much thermal imaging across time, so that you could like differentiate between, you know, like a certain temperature at this point in time and a certain temperature at that point in time, and then like take a gradient across the whole bulk of the pyramid. That's what it seems like they're doing, which is a really smart idea. I don't know if it's exactly what they're doing, but it seems very interesting.
Well, we're trying to get somebody. We're trying to get somebody on from Egypt who knows the technology and knows what they're looking for. But they apparently seen some pretty striking results in that, you know, across the width of a block, they're getting temperature differences of several, you know, degrees up to 5 or 6 degrees, which is pretty remarkable.
I saw an image online. God knows what, Huffington Post or something like that. Who knows? You know, one of those kind of sites. It could have been anywhere.
HuffPost.
Yeah, Facebook, basically, kind of, right?
Yeah, they're basically
so there was
mainstream.
A thermal imaging picture where there was a picture across the blocks with the pre-picture of the people standing there and the post-picture of the blocks with a, you know, like a more red point on the eastern side of the Great Pyramid. That's what they were supposing. So it's interesting. I think that we're all due for some more information on what's going on with the Great Pyramid. It's obviously something much more than everyone's telling us.
Well, I think it is. And again, look at the timing. Because in the United States, as I said last night, and I've said in the last couple of days, we suddenly, for the first time in political discourse in a very long time, I can't remember it ever coming up in a previously presidential race or campaign, pyramids, you know, from Ben Carson's lips, Donald Trump is talking about how you build a pyramid, what's inside. Since when did pyramids coincident with the Egyptians announcing they found some new potentially hidden chambers in the Great Pyramid? Since when did pyramids kind of take on the discourse on both sides of the Atlantic and in two separate cultures separated by thousands of years? I mean, again, as someone who looks at patterns and dots and connections, I think we ought to pay attention to the way the conversation is flowing around the idea that pyramids have something important to tell us right now. Yes? Hello? Okay.
I just want to know if there's grain in anything other than food pyramids.
Please turn your device down. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Richard. It's Maren. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. Where are you calling from?
Good. I'm calling from Seattle, and I just wanted to let Laura know and the other caller know that I use an Audio-Technica AT2305XLR, and that goes into my Behringer mixer.
Did you write this down, Scott?
I'll get it on the archives.
Okay.
All right. That's it. That's all,
right.
all I wanted to say.
Thank you much. Good night. Okay, we are at the top of the hour. We shall be back momentarily, if I can make my technologies work here. Oh, why is it not working? There we are. Okay, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. This is Open Hailing Frequencies, Wednesday morning. It is 1:59 here in the Mountain States. This is Nick Skouros with STS-80. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Good morning, Joy.
Good morning. I wanted to call in about a couple of things. One, I think you asked a question about the nature of spellcasting.
Yes, I knew you were going to hear that.
Of keeping it open and pinging it
mm-hmm.
versus doing a ritual and then just sending the energy out when you're done and you've raised energy.
Mm.
That's different ways of doing it. I think it all depends on what you're trying to do. In the case of somebody like Jimmy Carter, who had a long-lasting health issue, and I hope people still keep thinking about him. At least that's my inclination, and that's my magical intuition. Because you want to have, you know, it's kind of like keeping somebody in your thoughts.
Right.
So you want to keep them in your thoughts so that they can receive whatever positive energy you're sending to them. There are other rituals where you're trying to get a specific goal to make it happen quickly and specifically. And like, let's say, oh, I don't know, maybe you want to get the money for a sanctuary or bring rain to an area or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you would maybe close it and send it, build the energy up in the ritual, and then send it out. But it's not necessarily that you aren't thinking about it. We've had some financial difficulties lately, so we did a little ritual for getting money. But I also keep pictures of Ganesha, who is a Hindu god that removes obstacles and helps with things like prosperity. And so I keep a picture of him up on my wall. And when I think about the fact that we've been having these monetary issues, I'll touch it and kind of connect back to that energy.
Mm.
So there's a lot of different ways to do ritual and magic. It all depends on your intent and how you what you're trying to achieve.
Well, the thing that I was trying to achieve is like by keeping the case open, by keeping, you know, his template in front of us, every
right.
time we mention him, every time we mention the idea of consciousness technology, every time we mention Art's experiments or my experiments or the fact that, you know, when I had the heart attack, an awful lot of people, you know, rushed to my aid through virtual reality, and here I still am. So in the model that keeping him in our consciousness is important,
Oh, I agree.
Every time we ping the field, something positive is happening to Jimmy Carter, and today's diagnosis was pretty amazing, given
that all the experts
are saying, why is he still walking around? I mean, it's like they were dumbfounded that he's not, you know, 6 feet under. And
well,
again,
you know, I think,
go ahead.
I'm sorry?
I said go ahead.
I think there's one other reason why it might be that he is having such a positive result. If our pings are helping him, I don't know, you can call them prayers or spells or whatever, is because he's open to it.
Mm.
He's been a devout Baptist for years. He left the church because of the misogynistic attitudes. But he's someone who believes in the power of prayer. So I think that probably...
Well, what's really intriguing to me is all the experts are saying, oh my gosh, he's still with us. Isn't that amazing?
I was impressed when I saw the article today. I went, wow, maybe we did some good.
And we have to keep doing it. You know, the reason I brought this up tonight is because every time you ping this, something positive happens. It's kind of like that scene at the end of, Good Life. Scott, mm-hmm. You had something you wanted to add?
Oh, yeah, something that you enjoy we're talking about, although my one thing that was made crystal clear to me not too long ago was I had a particular intention going into it, and the result ended up being, I think, in a real way, a message from the universe or whomever, raise your horizons, don't limit your outcome.
Mm.
And that was pretty dramatic. I mean, it showed up for me personally in a very dramatic way. But yeah, you must be careful of the power and be specific. And even when you're specific, sometimes the universe nudges you and says, oh, come on, you can do better than that.
Have you seen that Geico commercial where the guy finds this lamp in his garage and he's polishing it and the genie shows up and he says, oh, I want $1 million.
Yeah.
And the next shot is out the front window, and there's all these deer walking around in suburbia.
Yeah,
be careful what you ask for.
Yep.
The universe is literal sometimes.
Anything else, Joy?
I wanted to ask you what you think about these volcanoes, the ice-spewing volcanoes on the surface of Pluto.
Well, are they ice-spewing volcanoes? That's what the official captions read, but we know that the official captions don't really relate to what we're seeing now, don't we?
Well, yeah, but what do you think this is, then?
Well, look, Pluto is such an extraordinary example of the unknown. You know, all the models, except the one I proposed in Pluto New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, have turned up to be wanting. I'm the only guy that got it right, and, of course, my model is really far out there in that I propose in this book, which was published in the spring, in March, and the actual data didn't come in beginning until July, that the Pluto system is a created system. In other words, they took one from column A, one from column B, and it basically is a memorial to what happened after the incredible Great Solar System War. And it's an archive, and it was designed to preserve as many people as possible for as long as possible. The moons orbiting it are not really moons. They're really spacecraft, space habitats, like Nix, looks like one of the arcologies we see down on the surface, except it's whirling around Pluto in orbit, in a coplanar orbit with Charon and Hydra and Cerberus and the other moons. So,
why would
yeah.
it be so far away from the sun, though?
It's far Hello? Away to keep it preserved. And you know, please wait your turn.
Am I on?
Yes, you're listening. You're not on yet.
I'm sorry.
Just, you know, I do this so people can join the conversation and not be left out. So mute your mic, and when it's your turn, I will let you know. Okay, so where was I? So the reason it's so far out is to preserve it from the chaos and destruction that occurred in the inner solar system, which wound up mopping up all the materials that we see. All the artificial structures have been bashed and battered and destroyed by incredible micrometeorite onslaughts from when you destroy a planet in the inner system. The dust goes everywhere, and it goes everywhere at miles per second, and it's as destructive as thousands upon thousands of nuclear weapons. So the only way to preserve something is to stick it far away from the sun at a high inclination orbit so it doesn't come down through the plane very often, And so the materials on its surface will be left in a relatively untouched condition, and that's what we seem to be seeing at Pluto. But in terms of ice volcanoes, that's the mainstream kind of closing their eyes and throwing darts into a big board because their models cannot explain what they're seeing.
Okay. Well, okay. I'm open to that description, but I'm still kind of perplexed about how there could be volcanoes on Pluto.
It's a long story, and we'll tackle it when we get the imaging team back together in the next week or so.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Are you going to do a show on it?
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, good, good. I'd like to hear what you're
going to say. So we will move on. Joy, thanks for the call.
All right, have a good night.
And thanks for clearing up the whole spell thing. That really does make me feel better.
Good, all right. Okay.
All right, bye. Okay, let's see. Let's add Amanda to the group. Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Good. Nice weekend?
Nice is not exactly the term I would use. There's a lot of work to get some of these shows prepared, particularly the one for tomorrow night, which you're not going to want to miss.
I won't. I wanted to ask you a question and a few follow-up hypotheticals, if I could.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, do you know the happy hour comet?
The happy hour comet.
Yeah, and it's leaving a trail of alcohol and sugar.
No, I haven't heard it. Well,
I think Comet Lovejoy.
No. Oh, you mean the comet that they're seeing the alcohol and the other stuff? Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to know what you thought about that. If you really heard about it or.
Well, yeah. There are a lot of Comet Lovejoys, by the way. Lovejoy is an amateur astronomer, and he specializes in finding comets. And if you specialize in finding comets, you will find a lot of comets. So I think Lovejoy has five or six to his credit now. The way the International Astronomical Union works is that if you find a comet, you actually get it named after you. That's one of the few things in astronomy where they actually name it after the discoverer. If you find an asteroid, you get to decide as the discoverer what it's called, but it can't be called by your name. Only comets can be called by the discoverer's name. Anyway, just a bit of, arcana there. So this Lovejoy comet, to be separated from all the other comets that Lovejoy has found, appears to have an abundance of alcohol and sugar, which has been detected. Now, my question right away is, are we really sure this is the only comet that's ever been found to have these molecules? Because, I'm not conversant with the literature of cometary discoveries, but I seem to remember, even going back to the 50s and 60s, there were astronomers using spectroscopes that were detecting unusual molecules in cometary atmospheres. So, you have to be a little careful when someone says this is the first time ever, mm-hmm. particularly when it's really late in the process and we've been looking at lots and lots of comets. Like the other day, the Europeans, the Dawn mission, the Rosetta mission, announced they had found free oxygen coming from comet 67P. Well, given all the other comets that we've looked at and analyzed over the years, over the decades, I'm really wondering if this is the first comet that's ever been seen, or the first comet where it was seen and the numbers are so robust, the detection is so strong, that there is no doubt that there may have been previous examples where there was a lot of doubt, a lot of, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, but in this case, there's no doubt. So, again, I'm a little bit hesitant to say the first time for any of these discoveries is now, because it means that, well, what have they been doing over the last several decades or even a couple of hundred years? But yes, we are seeing unusual discoveries vis-a-vis comets, and if you stand back and you look at the big, big, big picture, which is that not all comets are natural Birkebeins formed in the origins of the solar system, then this leakage of this new information would tend to build a case that maybe some comets are not comets, but they're in fact what we think they are, which is space habitats, ancient space habitats.
Space habitats, that's very interesting. Because I was going to say, from what I was reading, I couldn't find the size of it, but it was saying, it would almost be like more like drinking alcohol rather than like something like the pure stuff like you would sanitize mm-hmm. something with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending on the size, what would happen if it hit something else, like an asteroid or whatever piece of space junk was flying around, and how close would it have to be for us to see anything, and is there a possibility if it was close enough, if everything lined up, like, would it affect us?
Well, we can start with the last question. Overwhelmingly not, because if you had a collision of two objects in space millions of miles away, the odds of anything from the collision reaching Earth is really, 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 really small, depending upon where it is in the sun's gravity field, whether it's upstream or downstream, in an inner orbit and an outer orbit, etc. If you were looking in the right direction when two objects in space collide, it might be rather spectacular. There would be heat and light involved. Lots of dust. So you would see infrared signatures in the infrared afterwards from all the dust. But, you know, most of the time, most of the things that go on in the solar system are not seen because there's a huge amount of space and there's a limited number of telescopes and astronomers and money and time and observing time. And so most of what's going on out there in real time is basically not seen. We only kind of get to the scene of the accident after the accident has taken place. Most of the time.
Well, because I was wondering, like, if, say, the comet that had alcohol coming from it or in it or whatever, if it hit and shattered and went in different directions and stuff, like, could it almost be like a forest fire? Like, if it hit
something else
that had...
No. Because remember, in order for something to burn, you have to have oxygen.
Oxygen, yeah.
And the oxygen in these objects is tied up as ice. So it's water ice, it's carbon dioxide ice, it's maybe ices of nitrogen. So you don't have free oxygen except at comet 67P. There's this bizarre source of free oxygen. But most objects in space do not have oxygen, which means they cannot have combustion or incineration. And so if you have collisions, depending upon the speed, there'd be a lot of fragments of stuff, but there'd be no... you know, Hollywood special effect, boom, with all kinds of stuff on the screen.
Mm.
So was that it?
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, like you said, if there's one, there's probably others. So, you know, just again, just hypothetical, kind of fun.
Okay,
thanks a lot.
Alrighty.
Nice evening. Bye.
You too. And we've got some open lines here. There's another call. Let's see who's calling. Where are you calling from and who are you?
So if you have collisions, depending upon
hello?
The speed,
there'd be a lot please of turn down your device. See, when you are put on the air, unless you turn down your device, I have to take you off the air because it is delayed. It's delayed by some estimates are up to like 30 seconds. I haven't actually timed it myself because I don't have a lot of free time to do that kind of timing on the air, but it is a long time. So if you want to join the conversation, when you call, please turn down your device, your phone, your whatever, and then we will add you, like this individual. Good morning, you're on the air. Hello? Okay.
Looks like my ride is here.
This seems to be sound effect night. Where were these people when we did the War of the Worlds show last week?
Yeah.
Okay. Area code 505-796-8802. 505-796-8802. Or enterprisemission.com. Let's see who this is. Good morning. You're on the air. Okay.
Lovely.
I don't think we're going to let that go out on the air.
Have we checked the status of the moon?
No, but I'm almost afraid to. Mario, you're on the air.
Yeah, no, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm not going to leave you hanging, boys. How are you? I'm calling you from Australia.
Another Australia. Gosh, it's early morning or is it after sunset over there? I can never remember.
It's after sunset
over
here.
Just after sunset, okay.
Yeah, we seem to have a common dialogue about the sunset, I've noticed.
Well, it's just such an interesting thing. I'm sitting here in northern New Mexico, the land of enchantment. It was very windy earlier tonight. It was a dark and stormy night in the land of enchantment. And then with the touch of a screen, I can be literally transported 12,000 miles away on the other side in the Antipodes to someone calling just after sunset on another part of the planet. I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling.
It's pretty cool. It really is. And when you think back to how far we've come, 40, 50 odd years ago, it's a pretty big deal.
It's a huge deal. So where do you want to take people?
Well, look, I'm actually curious to know, since the release of the NASA images that they've done through Flickr, I think it was about 10,000 odd images, mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if you have come across anything interesting in those photos or if anyone's reported anything interesting, specifically I'd say in reference to your book that you've released, Dark Mission?
Yes, that was several years ago. That was back in
2006. So I was just curious if you found anything interesting between the images released and the book. So I personally, because there were so many images, I thought you've got a lot of listeners and someone might have seen something.
What I've been able to do, and I haven't had a lot of time to do it, is I've gone and looked at a few of the images that we actually put in Dark Mission to check whether the sourcing of the new images was as good as the sourcing we had in the ones that we put in the book, and in fact it is. They are the same archived images. They've simply been made public. They've been taken out of – I mean, they're not exactly secret. They've been out there for, you know, like a decade, but on very specialized websites that you had to be kind of in the community to know about. And what the Flickr did was to take those semi-private images that weren't really private. They were out there. And some of them were referenced in Dark Mission.
Yes.
And they've now made them public all over the web, so you can instantly reach them by going to Flickr and going through the numbers. And yes, there's some interesting stuff. You just have to be very patient because it's so beaten and destroyed and shattered by meteor impacts that basically on our moon, the evidence of ancient, you know, archaeology of ancient ruins is very, very hard to find. Because you got to look through so much noise before you find geometry that's still standing.
Oh, yeah, there you go. See, I was under the impression the images that you've had access to were basically through other means and maybe not necessarily available publicly.
Well, some aren't. The ones that you can check publicly now, we've checked against what's on Flickr, and it's the same images. You know, digital is digital is digital. A copy of a copy of a copy is, you know, basically as good as, you know, the high-end JPEG compression, if they compress them using that algorithm.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, there was actually really clean images. So
yeah.
I wasn't sure if they were any cleaner than the ones that you were able to originally obtain. So if you've been able to pull out any more detail.
There are some that we obtained years ago that I've never been able to find anywhere else since. They came from a secret source.
Yes.
I've been trying to see whether the honest guys inside NASA would eventually post these amazing secret images. They were taken of the Apollo 17 landing site, and they are dramatically different than what you see all across the web, including on the Flickr site. So, and I tried to have one of my colleagues quietly go to the people who would put these images up on this website, and my emissaries were rebuffed. They were not entertained. They were not answered. They were not, you know, given the, oh, come on over and let's talk, that kind of thing.
So
I think that the whoever is behind that site was trying to use it to get certain imagery out in the public domain so that we would have an ability to kind of compare, but they did not want to be interviewed. They didn't want to be talked to. They didn't want to be on the record. They wanted to remain anonymous, and obviously if that's their wish, there's not much I can do about it.
Exactly. No, it's all good and well. All right, great. Thanks, Richard.
Okay. Call again.
Will do.
And let's go to this individual. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Who are you and where are you calling from?
Oh, Mike. I'm in Oregon.
In Oregon, okay. And what would you like to talk about?
Well, I listen to a lot of the interviews with the alternative theorists and so forth, such as Richard.
Yes.
Today I listened to someone who, Eric Dubay, D-U-B-A-Y, I believe it is. But anyway, he's one of these flat Earth proponents.
I'm not a big fan of the flat Earth.
Are you a screener?
Hello? Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Oh, that's much okay. Better. It's much better, yes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was on a ear cord on a phone.
Still a little echoey. But, what else did you want to ask?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to ask if he'd listened to any of these.
You know, when Art had him on months ago, I listened to part of it, and frankly, you know, he's a bright guy. He's obviously got the wrong, you know, hind leg of the dog, as my grandmother used to say.
And I heard that actually on the radio, on the Portland radio station.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Portland area, and they pretty much didn't give him a chance to say much. But
Art gave him a chance. And,
did he?
You know, yeah.
Okay, I heard about an hour of it, hour and a half.
Well, go ahead, Scott.
No, I think that was the guy, it's the same one I'm thinking of, who was saying that the sun was only 3,000 miles above the surface of the flat Earth.
Yeah, in the interview I listened to today, he mentioned that, and I didn't realize that it was probably the same person.
It's the same person.
But he was very coherent in this interview I listened to today. I believe it was with a competitor of yours that I like.
Well,
I don't know if I can mention
that.
You can mention anybody.
Art gave him plenty of
time. Oh, okay. Veritas, I think, is quite a good interview. I think his name is Mel Fabregas. He's pretty good. I'm not calling for him, but that's just the interview I listened to today.
So that was the was the show that this Flat Earth guy was on?
Right. Same guy, apparently. Because I believe he said that the sun, you know, and his part of what I thought did make sense is we think of the horizon going over around a bend, but a horizon could also just be perspective and just...
I think we're having packet drop again.
Yeah, the guy in question that Art was talking to, he gave him loads of time, but he never got around to explaining why we aren't all fricasseed with the sun being just 3,000 miles above the surface. He never did make that clear.
Well, it's one of several things.
Rolls up the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George.
Okay.
I thought it was Casey Kasem there for a second.
Good morning, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Where are you calling from?
Scotty. Hello?
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from California. Actually, I'm right by the NASA Ames Research Center.
Oh, okay. Mountain View.
Mountain View. Yeah. Actually, I wrote Scotty an email earlier tonight and suggested a guest. I don't know if you agree with it or not, but I've been following the works of Jim Fitzer, and he has a new book out called Nobody Was Killed at Sandy Hook, and he had another book about the moon. He doesn't think we went to the moon at all, and I was wondering if you would debate him on the show.
Let me have Scott look into it, and we'll let everybody know. Okay. We are at the bottom of the hour. You are on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. This is another Nick tune, Lana Cella. We shall return.
You know, this reminds me of back in the 70s when I was a telephone operator on the overnight shift.
Mm-hmm.
You could always tell when the moon was doing something. But I looked out the weather window. It's 53 degrees under clear skies with a crescent moon, I think, or quarter moon, here east of downtown Oz. So that's our look out of the weather window for tonight. But sometimes.
Sometimes.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Fantastic. I'd like to talk a little bit about Pluto.
Sure.
Are you kind of waiting for the new high-res to come in? Because I think they're pretty amazing pictures. especially on some of those that were on the horizon. On the left side of the one of the pictures that you posted, it's probably like 3 weeks ago on your Pluto show.
One of the look back panoramas, yes.
It looks like there's a perfectly round, it almost looks like a massive, you know, it looks like a swimming pool, but it's huge on the left side. Have you seen that?
Yes. And in fact, it does look like a huge Olympus swimming pool. Like it was terraced, and it's got, you know, scallops, and it's got geometry. And
it's perfectly round, and it sits on top of another round hill.
Yeah, and you think it was an airplane shot of somewhere in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I was wondering, are there going to be new pictures coming in, like, Christmas time? Or?
Well, they're supposed to be dribbling them out bit by bit by bit, you know, for the last several weeks. They released another high-res close-up of the so-called Arcology Row, I think it was yesterday or today. I think it was yesterday.
Oh, sweet.
And a couple of us were kind of talking about it in the email this afternoon as I was getting ready to do the show tonight, but we haven't really had a chance to focus. It looks to me like Dr. Stern is being very careful now, because if he releases imagery which is too high resolution and it confirms what we have been saying is there, and it's done out of sequence, you know, if this is all a big orchestrated, you know, plan toward disclosure to where they finally admit what's out there in our backyard,
yeah,
and various parts of this machine can't get too far out ahead of other parts of the machine, otherwise the machine will go out of kilter.
I just can't believe these Pluto pictures, and I'm just dying for. I want your show to go to like 3 hours when you're talking about anomalies, because it seems like those are the shows that always end too quick.
Well, that's why we have more than one of them.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad you do that. All right, and I had a question about the Mars photos.
Okay.
It seems like, you know, when you're farther out, they don't look too impressive, but it seems like the closer in you go, I just keep seeing squares and geometry.
Yep.
Is that on the surface?
It's on the surface. No, it's jumbled ruins. You're looking at a huge suburb built all around these structures, these massive pyramids, and it took, you know, resolution on the order of inches per pixel to basically see it.
It's really not that impressive until you get up close, and then you're just like, oh, my goodness.
And then you realize the scale, and it goes on for thousands of square miles.
Yeah, it's absolutely stunning. It's like, am I really seeing this? Are other people seeing this? Like, I'm surprised Art hasn't seen it and just been blown away by it. I don't know. Anyways, thank you.
Okay.
It's nice to talk to you.
Same here.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay, let's see who this is. Good morning. You're on the air on the other side of midnight.
Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning. I got a question about a hypothetical question. I think it's Europa.
Oh, you faded out there.
I think it's Europa. That's the moon that's made out of pure water.
Well, not exactly. It does have a solid core. It's kind of like a mini moon with an ocean wrapped around it and ice above that. But it does have a core and a mantle.
Is that enough water to give Mars oceans back?
That's a good question. If Europa is about the size of our own moon, a little over 2,000 miles across, and it's got an ocean which is 100 miles deep, all right, with a thin covering of ice a few miles on top of that, and you take the total volume of that ocean, 100 miles deep, on an object about the size of our moon, 2,000 miles, there's probably more water in Europa's oceans than there are in all the oceans of this planet. So if you could somehow transport the water from Europa to Mars, yes, you could flood Mars to a very deep depth and replace its oceans. The only problem is, how would you transport the water? Because it's not inconvenient little icebergs. It's all locked up in ice on the surface of a moon orbiting the most massive planet in the solar system, which means you're going to have to invent a whole Type 2 civilization technology to do this, and maybe somebody did it a long time ago.
Yeah, something for our kids to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work. I enjoy listening to you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to this caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Richard. This is Glenn from Philadelphia.
Hi, Glenn. Oh, did you get down to see the ship yet?
No, Richard, I've done nothing. But work and recuperate, work and recuperate. That's all I've been doing.
Okay, well, tomorrow night, this director, producer, his name is Robert Radler, R-A-D-L-E-R, Robert Radler is going to be here. He has done two documentaries on saving the SS United States. And we're going to spend 2 hours in an extraordinary retrospective and a future projection for how important this ship, this amazing ocean liner, the most extraordinary ocean liner ever built in the modern history of the world, and she's sitting there in Philadelphia at a pier, quietly moldering back into the Atlantic Ocean because no one wants to save her. So tomorrow night, we're going to talk about the SS United States, what it means to us, why we should save her, and what saving her can mean to the saving of the entire country.
Well, this should be interesting. It's really quite attractive, I mean, to look at it. You know, it reminds me of the classic look of a ship, you know, that I would passenger ship from when I was a kid, you know, you'd see.
Oh, wait till you hear her story. It's an amazing story. And we've unearthed details about this ship that nobody else has talked about for decades.
Wow. I guess financing is probably the biggest issue. They should be able to do, if they were going to fix it up, they should be able to do it right here in Philadelphia. I mean, we'd have the Philadelphia Naval Yard right down at the, you know, on the river down near the airport. And, they used to have the Naval Shipyard there that was, did a lot of military ship refits, but then that was privatized years ago. But I'm sure it's got, you know, more than adequate facilities to do something like that. But it's all a matter of money, and I'm sure probably more fundraising than anything.
Money and motivation and giving people a reason why this cannot be allowed to disappear. And as I said, Robert Radler, the director and producer of these two amazing films, he's done so many other films. He's done feature films. You know, he's done HBO specials. He's done... If I read down, you know, The Best of the Best was one of his feature films that starred Eric Roberts and James Earl Jones and Sally Kirkland and Christopher Penn. And, you know, this is a major producer director who is trying to save this ship. And we're going to join him tomorrow night and we'll find out all about what needs to happen and why we should care.
They have, I believe they still have the Olympia down on the Delaware, and that has its own little Preservation Society, which I believe that's the flagship from the Spanish-American War.
I'm not sure. I thought she was maybe berthed somewhere south of there, but I could be wrong. Okay. Oh, it looks like we've lost him. Okay. Riley, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, Richard?
I'm just keeping on, keeping on. It's an interesting open hailing frequencies night. The moon is obviously in Scilly. Or it's somewhere over the yard arm for the Belgab folks, because they've been very, very busy. Little bees over there.
I was wanting to just get your thoughts on, have you ever heard of Randall Carlson?
Why does that name ring a bell? Randall Carlson. Randall.
He's got a bunch of old Earth theories. He worked with Graham Hancock.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He's got a lot of really old theories about, you know, like...
Can you speak up just a bit?
Oh, sorry if my mic's away. But yeah, he's got a lot of theories about, you know, like what happened, you know, in ancient human civilizations. Like he seems to think we've risen and fallen multiple times. And
well, he's right on that.
He's got geological evidence to that fact. I was just wondering if you'd ever come across him at
all.
Do you
have any contact info? Sounds like someone we should be talking to.
Well, he's been on the Joe Rogan podcast semi-recently.
Okay.
He was on there twice. Definitely check him out if you get the chance. But, okay.
If anybody out there wants to send us contact info for any guests, you know, suggestions, whatever, if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and the right-hand side under the banner, there's a little contact thing. You press that, and that takes you to me or to Scott or to our webmaster, Rich Roland. You can send us suggestions. You can send submissions for the fan art gallery, which is both art and music. And if you copy Scott on guest suggestions, that is more efficient because I'm overloaded and I can't go and pursue a lot of these myself, which is why we have able people to pursue them. So, yes, please, if you get contact info, send it in and we will.
Yeah, I'll do my best to get that. Yeah, for sure.
Super. Anything else?
No, that's it, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Come again.
Yep. Thanks.
Bye. Okay, let's try. Oh, they went away. Oh, darn, I thought it was going to be another bell gabber. Okay, let's see if we can set a trap here. All right.
What do we use for bait?
Pussycats? No, you can't do that. No. 505-796-8802. Or Enterprise Mission is our Skype handle. And let's see who this is. Good morning, you're on the air.
Anything else? No, that's it, man. I appreciate it.
Sounds like a pussycat.
You know, Ted Mack somewhere is weeping because he missed all of this talent.
Okay, let's see who this is. Good morning, you're on the air.
This is Ronnie Martin. Hey, how are you?
Good morning.
I have better things to do than...
I don't think that is someone we want to put on the air. Oh, incidentally, for Laura London, that's how her name came up on the Skype thing. The audio earphone mic combo that I'm using is Audio Technica. It's BPHS1. That's the model number. Audio Technica, B as in boy, P as in Paul, H as in Hoagland, S as in Sam, number one. And let's take a chance here and see who this is. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. I don't think that's a reasonable person.
Hello.
Okay.
What do you say after you say hello?
Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Richard. I got a guest suggestion that I'm really surprised I've never heard come up on either your show, George's, or ours, and it's an alien abduction type investigator author named Raymond Fowler. You ever heard of him?
Oh, Ray Fowler, yes, from New England. He wrote a series of books.
Right.
Yeah, he wrote about Betty Andreessen, the Andreessen Affair.
Right, and The Watchers, mm-hmm. and others. Yeah, I've never heard him be interviewed.
I don't know whether he's even still with us, but Scott, that might be a useful thing, because he was a very serious UFO researcher in the era when it was very hard to be serious about UFO research. And so if he's still around, it might be nice to talk to him. So please note that down. Thanks for the suggestion.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Have a great one.
Okay, you too. Okay, we've got a few minutes left in our very interesting open hailing frequencies tonight. If you have an unknown phone number, you're not going to be called because we know who that leads back to. You know, it's so interesting that I can entertain so many people by just sitting here and doing what we normally do, like answer the phones. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello? You're on the air. Hello?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
Am I?
You're on the air.
Okay. Do you have a one call per night rule, as Art does?
Yeah, usually.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to say I don't believe in the flat earth theory.
Okay.
This is Mike from Oregon. I just thought it was an interesting thought experiment.
Okay, so now you're into 1.5. That means you can't call for at least a week. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
You too. Bye. Okay. No, just one call per night, guys. Come on. You know the rules. You know, there's a very simple reason for that rule. It's so the other people can get a chance to get in and communicate whatever it is that they want to communicate. And no, we're not taking all those unknown phone numbers that were just created to call this show tonight for some reason. 505-796-8802. Enterprise Mission is our Skype name.
I must say that some of the animal impressions have been quite spectacular. I
well, I don't know. I've actually heard better, you know, in the jungle. When we were, you know, measuring pyramids, the most astonishing was the howler monkeys at dawn, and they literally live up to their name. And we got all this footage of all these monkeys screaming and yelling and shouting obscenities at dawn as the as you know, the mist arising over the spires sticking out of the jungle around Tikal. It was very, very photogenic and very audiogenic.
I'm surprised with all the confusion the bird hasn't chimed in with, because normally he will chime in if he's motivated.
Well, he has to have the proper motivation. 505-796-8802. There seems to be a lull. Enterprise Mission is our handle on Skype. So let me finish telling you about tomorrow night. So we're going to have Robert Radler on, and he's going to describe the efforts he's been involved with now for several years, for probably at least 20 years, to save this remarkable ship. Good morning. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Good morning, Mr. Hoagland. My name is Patricia Pruitt, and I'm calling from Oakland, California.
Oh, I used to live in Oakland.
Wonderful, wonderful. You called us useless eaters.
No, I didn't.
And I would like...
No. Patricia, no. No, Patricia, I did not. No, Patricia.
What you need to...
Patricia,
all right.
Do you want me to tell you what I said?
Those words came out of your mouth somehow, and perhaps you didn't say them or mean to say them, but they came out of your mouth.
But I didn't mean them in the way that a number of people have apparently interpreted them. I was using an analogy.
In gentleness, I would like to ask for an apology.
I totally apologize if you took it wrong. I did not mean it that way.
That's an if-pology. Look it up.
It's a what?
It needs to be sincere, an if-pology. Like I said, look it up.
Well, how can I apologize if you're not offended? You have to first be offended. Are you offended? Did you think I actually called you a useless eater?
Yes.
You thought I called you a useless eater. Why would you think that?
I heard you say that, and about your listeners.
No, you heard me make an analogy.
It seemed that you likened us to useless eaters.
Little
no. Than actually calling us useless.
What I did was, would you like to have a
conversation?
Patricia, would you like to have a conversation about this? You know, if you want to just do a diatribe, go right ahead. I'll just sit here and listen.
Good. You should listen. I'm trying to tell you something that's important for your future, personal and professional. People need an apology, man. And on behalf of Gene, who gave so much to this world, you were his friend. I don't know what he was like as a person, but I think from his position now, he would want you to apologize.
Who are you talking about?
Mr. Roddenberry, your friend that you always talk about.
Right.
We love him, too. He gave us a future. And you're treating us like we're useless eaters.
No, I'm not.
I was
not
hurt.
At all.
And believe me, although I'm subscribing to Art Bell, my subscription to you is not going to happen. I wish you luck, sir, and I ask you to really think about this with your heart. Good night.
Good night, Patricia. Just for the record, I did not call my listeners useless eaters. I used an analogy, a metaphor. I used several imageries that night, some of which, if I had to do over again, I probably wouldn't. See, when you're on the radio and you don't have video and pictures, you're trying to create in the minds of an audience a visual image. And one of the visual images that came to my mind as I'm describing this complicated process with bandwidth is a car commercial, which has to do with car insurance. And it has a whole bunch of people leaping out of the bushes onto cars, you know, because, well, the thrust of the commercial is that if you don't want to pay, you know, exorbitant rates, you go with this car company and you won't pay exorbitant rates. The problem is when you're trying to describe visual imagery on the radio and you're only used to and limited to language, sometimes the tongue can get ahead of itself and you make connections that you're not intending. For anyone who was offended by what I said the other night, I obviously did not intend, nor do I think, nor would I ever think of this audience in that connection, because you're demonstrably not. You know, every time I open the phone lines, except for tonight with some weird crank calls, the caliber of the calls, the caliber of the questions, the caliber of the conversation from anywhere on earth has been exemplary. You know, I've done nothing but compliment everyone who has been part of the show, who was going to be part of the show. But yes, sometimes, you know, we're all human and we make, you know, foul-ups. that require explanation. And again, for those people who were offended, because no one who listened to my language actually would have thought I was calling you specifically a particular name. I was using an analogy, calling up imagery, which frankly probably should not have been used in connection with the show. And I have learned something. Yes, Patricia, I have learned something. I appreciate your calling. I wish you'd stuck around and let me explain it to you in person. But I do apologize to you if you were offended. I did not mean to include my audience in a blanket, whatever. And let's see who else we have here in the time we have remaining. Good morning. You're on the air.
How you doing tonight, RC?
It's been up and down, you know.
It's sounding like a rough one there, but.
Well, look, none of us is without, you know, sin. None of us does not make mistakes. When you're called upon to speak off the top of your head without notes every night, five nights a week, you know, 360 whatever days a year, there are times when you're going to misspeak, you know. Most people got that I did not intend to call them what some people thought I was calling them. And again, for those who took it the wrong way, I did not obviously mean it, and I apologize.
Well, this is your friend Ron from out here in Woodstock area. I call every week or so and just thought I'd drop a line tonight. I was curious to see if you'd heard anything about Robert Bigelow and what he's been up to.
Not lately. I know that he's involved in spacecraft that can be, you know, inflated and deployed and can be habitats. I'm fascinated to see where his technology is going to take us, because it's going to be needed pretty soon now if we're going to spread out through the solar system, which is what I think is going to happen in the not-too-distant future. There's going to be a call to reinvigorate space, because there's lots of money to be made in them thar hills.
Yeah, he's talked about doing that hotel up there. Mm-hmm. Possible moon bases and doing it through private corporations, which I think would be great.
If Dave Dissler's technology, the M-Drive, pans out, and we actually can, aside from NASA, aside from the Air Force, aside from all the black ops crowd, if we can create a space drive that actually can take us into orbit without the fuss and fury and flame of conventional rocketry, everything changes, and Bigelow stands to make billions and billions of dollars in the hotel business in Earth orbit.
Yeah, nobody's done any interviews with him in quite some time. I just had, you know, just like he dropped off the radar, I just hadn't heard nothing much on him lately.
Well, there are people that do and people who talk, and a lot of times people who do remain more private.
Another quick question for you.
Yeah, we got about a minute left.
Okay, I just wondered if there was, you know, everybody, when they get talking artificial gravity, it's pretty much just a rotating body or whatever that they're going to implement as their vehicle.
Centrifugal force, yes.
Yeah, centrifugal force. Are we anywhere near any other type of a gravitational platform like
that? Funny, you should ask, because if you reverse the idea of the M-Drive, you can create an artificial gravity system if you reverse that technology.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's our music, and there's the end of the show.
All right. Good
morning, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Have you a good one.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
So that's another show for Wednesday morning, Open Hailing Frequencies. Remember, tomorrow morning, our guest is going to be Robert Radler. And we're just going to be discussing the past and future of the SS United States. Until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on, till morning. Good night, everyone.